But it's also fighting in with them. It's just like giving in to me, from my point of view.
North Slope Inupiat react to an agreement with Shell. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 8th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Miller campaign goes toe-to-toe with the Division of Elections.
We don't contact candidates. We'd have to contact, you know, every candidate that ran for office to advise them that this was happening.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The head of the federal agency that oversees offshore drilling says decisions are coming soon about whether oil companies can drill off Alaska's coast. Michael Bromwich, director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, says both the companies and the groups fighting offshore drilling deserve to know what will happen. Bromwich made his comments yesterday on the C-SPAN interview program Newsmakers.
We're going to be making some decisions that will bear on that in the relatively near future. But we know we need to resolve this issue because nobody likes uncertainty. And so we need to provide an answer so people understand which direction they're going to be permitted to go. We understand that, and we'll try to make decisions in a timely way.
Bromwich says the main concern is how to clean up oil spills in the Arctic, where conditions are dramatically different than in the Gulf of Mexico, the site of the BP oil well blowout last April. Bromwich says icy waters pose unique challenges, as does the Arctic's remoteness, far from Coast Guard stations and cleanup infrastructure.
So even though it's not deep water, and the geology is different, and the nature of the drilling would be different, the fundamental questions that we are still grappling with is, have we been given adequate answers on spill response? And if not, what additional steps need to be taken in order to satisfy ourselves that drilling in the Arctic can take place within a tolerable risk? We're still wrestling with those questions right now, but we haven't reached any decisions.
After the BP blowout, the Interior Department put on hold Shell Oil Company's exploratory wells in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. Bromwich has met with Alaska Native and environmental groups concerned about the effects of offshore drilling and with the companies who want to operate there. The BOEM will conduct a public hearing on environmental concerns from a 2008 lease sale in Alaska's Chukchi Sea at 7 tomorrow evening in Anchorage. The former Minerals Management Service in February 2008 conducted a lease sale in the Chukchi off Alaska's northwest coast, receiving high bids totaling $2.7 billion and issuing 487 leases. Environmental and Alaska Native groups sued, and in July, a federal court judge said environmental information was lacking. The BOEM will collect testimony on the effect of natural gas development, on whether missing information was essential, and whether the cost of obtaining the missing information is exorbitant. In the meantime, Shell launched a new ad campaign in major East Coast publications today, touting job creation and their spill response plans in the push for Arctic drilling. The recent announcement of an agreement between Shell and the North Slope Borough for scientific collaboration on offshore drilling studies is being met with disappointment by the president of the Native Village of Point Hope, Caroline Cannon.
What another blow, you know. It's just like giving in to the oil industry, in a sense. Although I know that coming from a scientific perspective, it's critical that we have all this data. But it's also fighting in with them. It's just like giving in to me, from my point of view.
Cannon says the Point Hope Native government structure has been in place since 1934, and she says leaders have learned a lot about how to tackle the stacks of documents that must be read through before making official comments on emerging Arctic plans.
We're knowledgeable in a sense when it pertains to the ocean, but we're not the doctors or the scientifics in this area. So I know that the tribe has made some comments, and I know that, you know, we don't take this lightly.
She says the tribe makes an effort to comment on every notice that comes through on Arctic policy. Today, a presidential commission opened 2 days of hearings on the BP Gulf of Mexico blowout. They saw a picture of a piece of pipe from the deepwater well site that had literally been sandblasted to shreds by the force of the material coming out of the well. The presidential commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling had heard its chief counsel, Fred Bartlett, reveal his findings about the spill and quiz executives of BP and its contractors about whether they agreed or disagreed with those findings. Bartlett says it does not look as if anyone involved with the well was deliberately taking safety risks to save money. BP and its contractors Halliburton and Transocean have deep disagreements about what caused the blowout, and Bartlett said one way to get to the bottom of these disagreements would be to have subpoena power to get testimony under oath and be able to cross-examine witnesses. But that's something that Congress has so far not given the commission, and its report is due in January. Halliburton was responsible for the cement that was used to cap the well. That cement failed. Oil, gas, and sand came right through it. Halliburton contends the cement might have worked better if BP had done more to keep the center part of the well separate from the casing. Transocean was the drilling contractor. It is conducting an internal investigation of the incident. And today, Transocean Special Projects Director Bill Ambrose shared some of the results, including a picture of the pipe that was not completely pinched off by blowout preventer, or BOP, located at the wellhead. He told Bartlett that in a matter of just a couple of minutes, it was simply shredded by the force of the material swirling out.
The eroded area there that you see in the middle, we believe that this piece was closed in that upper annular of the riser of the BOP. And you know, this is what happened when they closed the BOP. The hook load, if you look at that trend.
Please tell what the commission what the hook load is.
Hook load is the weight of the drill string that you can measure. The hook load decreased during this period of time where everything started happening fast, fluid started moving quickly. And this particular tool joint, which was positioned, we believe, originally between the two annulars, the upper and the lower annular, moved upward into the upper annular. And when he closed the annular, there are actually some metal fingers that position that and squeeze that closed, that the fingers contacted the tool joint and then caused this washing or erosion to occur and allowed flow to continue.
Was the annular here, and this is gas rushing past the annular that did this, or is it the other way around?
That's correct, gas and fluid. It would have been moving from left to right on the picture.
Okay, so the annular is here. It's closed or part closed, but some gases are getting through it. And these gases and the sands they carry with them are so powerful, they just eroded this piece of steel. Is this carbon steel?
It's a S-135 PSI material, yeah.
Pretty good stuff.
PSI. Yeah, and this happened in several minutes. Yeah. This is just several minutes.
This gives us an idea what a couple of minutes of these sands coming up here can do to steel like this.
That was Spill Commission Chief Counsel Fred Bartlett questioning Transocean Executive Bill Ambrose. The hearings continue tomorrow in Washington. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering a pioneer in the treatment of alcoholism.
Alaska has lost such a cherished and remarkable human being.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Richard Nelson, anthropologist and host of Encounters, is coming to Anchorage as part of the Alaska News Fund Speaker Series, bringing public broadcasting faces to Alaska. Richard Nelson will be in Anchorage at the Anchorage Museum Auditorium on Friday, November 12th. For ticket information, go to aprn.org or call 550-8400. Proceeds will benefit APRN Alaska News Fund.
The Division of Elections says Joe Miller's campaign did not follow the rules and give the division the name of a contact person, which is why they weren't notified Friday that the process to validate absentee ballots had begun. The division is responding to claims by Miller that the state agency is manipulating the counting process and keeping important information from him. Miller's campaign put out a press release over the weekend complaining that the Division of Elections hadn't notified him that it had started validating absentee ballots. But the Division of Elections Division Director, Gail Fanumiai, says Friday is the first time her office heard from Miller's group about the ballot review process.
Unless a candidate or campaign, a party, advises us that they are interested in participating in that observation, which is open to them, we don't contact candidates. We'd have to contact, you know, every candidate that ran for office to advise them that this was happening. And that's been our process for years. And it's spelled out in our observer handbook that once they make contact with us, then they give us names and we provide that information to them, which is what we did on Friday when we were contacted by the Miller organization. And they did participate in this process in the primary. They had a copy of our handbook.
Campaigns are required by state law to put forth the name of a contact person for election information. Miller's spokesman says they did do that, but the Division of Elections Fanumiai disagrees.
We were contacted during the primary that they were interested in participating in the absentee review, and as always, we allowed that to happen. And we didn't get that information from them until last Friday the 5th.
The division also says there's a difference between counting absentee ballots, which starts tomorrow, and verifying absentee voter eligibility, which is the process that started late last week. So Miller's complaint that the counting was unexpectedly moved up is incorrect, according to division officials. Miller has also raised concerns about the state's decision to move up by 10 days the process to begin write-in ballots. It starts Wednesday. Both his campaign and that of Senator Lisa Murkowski, the other top competitor in the Senate race, are mobilizing volunteers and lawyers to watch the hand counting. Miller says the quickened timeline gives him less time to prepare, and the fact that it's being done in Juneau will make it tough for him to get teams in place. A pioneer in the Alaska sobriety movement has passed away. Ernie Turner died from cancer on October 31st. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Turner was born in 1930 in Shagaluk, Alaska. He was sent to a sanitarium in Washington State after contracting tuberculosis. Drinking that began when he was a teenager progressed until he became what he called a hopeless street drunk. Turner's family says that after he went into treatment and studied alcoholism, he came to believe that it's a biological disease, genetic in origin, and fatal if untreated, but that effective treatment and active membership in a 12-step program makes recovery not only possible, but probable. Doyon Board Chairman Ori Williams credits Turner with steering him towards sobriety.
So I learned from his experiences on the street and his lifelong experiences as an Athabascan man that what the disease was all about and how I could stop it. And that was over 25 years ago. So to me, he was a hero and a lifesaver. Not just myself, but the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other people in Alaska and across the country.
Alaska has lost such a cherished and remarkable human being in Ernie Turner.
That's Rural Cap Anchorage Services Director Melinda Freeman. Freeman says he also had great strength of character.
Through everything he did, his integrity and his compassion and depth of caring for people just stood out.
Turner also was a pioneer in the establishment of treatment programs for Native Americans. He set up or was the driving force behind two treatment centers in Washington and one in Alaska, the Ernie Turner Center on Tudor. Freeman says Turner also helped people like her who were working with people in recovery from addiction.
And so from the point that I met him, he was always someone who we would go to for wise counsel related to helping people who were addicted to alcohol.
His family has scheduled a celebration of Ernie Turner's life for November 12th in Seattle. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A suspected fraud artist became snared in a trap set by three of her former victims, who then contacted the Anchorage police. Police are now looking for more victims while joining the Better Business Bureau in warning against internet fraud. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
When an Anchorage man discovered the Dorothy concert tickets he'd purchased on Craigslist were counterfeit, he returned to the website in search of fellow victims. He found two who had also used the same phone number to buy phony tickets. Together, they combed through Craigslist until they discovered snowboard bindings for sale with the identical phone number. They arranged to buy the bindings, and when the suspect appeared in a parking lot driving the same car, they notified police. 21-year-old Shanda Barlow of Anchorage is charged with three counts of forgery, third degree, and three counts of theft by deception. Barlow also had an outstanding warrant for $10,000. Her bail was set at $15,000 with a required third-party custodian for release. Lieutenant Dave Parker, Anchorage police spokesman, says investigators are looking for more victims.
We know that there were at least five victims, so we have two that are currently missing, and we would really like to find them. And the reason we know that is one of our clerks was at that concert. She observed five people with ticket problems, and there may be well more than that.
Parker says the police regularly receive complaints about internet and Craigslist transactions. He offers some advice.
It's best to make some kind of contact and make sure that you have that person's identity nailed down before you accept anything from someone on the internet.
The Craigslist scam doesn't surprise Tara Sims. Sims works in the Alaska office of the Better Business Bureau.
Probably the schemes that we see the most are when people are posting something on Craigslist to sell and they get consumers trying to buy from them, but they're saying, okay, well, I really want to purchase. They ask you all lots of questions. And then they send you a check for more than what you're asking for.
One tip you're a scam target is when the would-be buyer asks you to forward extra money to a third party for shipping or other service. Sims says once the buyer cashes the check and gives the money as requested, he or she can become an unwitting fraud accomplice.
The money being sent in the check is actually stolen money from a real person or business. And the money that you're forwarding it to the third party belongs to somebody else. So what happens is months down the road, you get a call from a bank or a government agency saying you've been involved in check fraud, and you have to pay back all the money, including the money that you sent to the third party, which really happened to be the scam artist.
This scam is not limited to Craigslist. It's also struck buyers using old-fashioned classified ads. Sims describes a local man selling puppies encountering a buyer who had a friend to handle the shipping. The seller became suspicious.
The person did some research online and found out that other people had been receiving these types of offers and that it was a scam, and so he was able to make the decision not to sell to that person, so the puppies were safe.
As was his money. Beyond Craigslist, Sims suggests checking out vendors on the Better Business Bureau website if this is the first time you're dealing with them over the internet. Sims says there you'll find customer concerns and complaints. She has more advice when making a purchase over the internet.
The easiest way to do that is instead of looking for HTTP in front of the web address, look for HTTPS, S as in secure.
Lieutenant Parker suggests consumers might also want to check the Internet Crime Complaints Center for internet scams, preferably before falling victim and filing their own complaint. That national site is www.ic3.gov. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The State Board of Game yesterday declined to take action on a proposal that would have modified the allowable harvest for brown bear on Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof Islands. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association submitted the proposal, which would have prohibited ADF&G from counting annual defense of life and property brown bear kills when figuring brown bear harvest caps in Unit 4. The association argues that defense of life and property kills increased significantly over the past several years. The proposal states that the increase is often the result of poor garbage management and has little to do with wildlife management related to sport hunting. The association argues the defense of life and property kills are inappropriately indicating concerns with overharvest of brown bears by hunters. Sitka area wildlife biologist Phil Mooney says defense of life and property brown bear kills have remained relatively flat over the last 30 years, averaging about 4% of brown bears taken in Unit 4 annually. Meanwhile, Mooney says the number of total brown bears harvested in Unit 4 has increased markedly in the past 30 years.
The harvest from the 80s has gone from around 1,000 until you get to essentially the end of the 2009 period of 1,600 bears. That's a lot.
The board declined to take up the Unit 4 brown bear proposal yesterday. Board member Ben Grusendorf says the board had previously agreed to leave the harvest cap decisions to Fish and Game staff.
When you talk about harvest guidelines set for brown bears in Unit 4, we have already authorized, the board has already authorized the department to make adjustments in that management program. And so the mortality and the questions like that, we've left to the department.
The Board of Game is meeting in Ketchikan through tomorrow, taking up hunting and trapping management proposals for Southeast Alaska. The board also shot down a proposal to shorten the wolf hunting season throughout much of Southeast. The proposal, floated by the Defenders of Wildlife, sought to shorten the hunting season for wolves by 2 months. Right now, the wolf hunting season in Game Management Units 1, 3, 4, and 5 runs from August 1st through April 30th. The proposal sought to change that to September 1st through March 31st. The Department of Fish and Game recommended the board reject the proposal. The Board of Game unanimously voted it down. How are an erupting volcano and good salmon season linked? If you don't know, neither did we, until Northwest News Network reporter John Ryan found a Canadian scientist who claims that an eruption in the Aleutians can put money in fishermen's pockets.
The Kasatochi volcano sits on a tiny island in the Bering Sea. It's part of Alaska, but it's closer to Russia than to Anchorage. When the volcano erupted in 2008, it smothered the island in a deep layer of rock and ash. Kasatochi was virtually sterilized. But a storm was forming over the island as the volcano erupted. It scattered volcanic ash to the southeast, over hundreds of miles of the North Pacific, where it had a different effect.
When the ash fell into the ocean, it released iron into the surface waters.
Roberta Hom is an oceanographer at the University of Victoria. She says the ash didn't sterilize the ocean, it fertilized it.
In this area of the ocean, the phytoplankton, these are the microscopic plants that live in the ocean, they have plenty of what they need to grow, but they don't have enough iron. So when the iron was added from this ash, suddenly they had everything they needed and they were able to grow quickly and reproduce.
Satellite images showed the tiny plants at the base of the ocean food chain went gangbusters. The plankton more than doubled their growth over an area of ocean bigger than Alaska. It was the biggest bloom of plankton ever seen in that part of the Pacific. Hom's study of the volcano-fueled plankton explosion was just published in September of this year. That was during another population explosion.
Whoa!
That's the sound of happy fishermen off Lummi Island near Bellingham this summer. They're watching hundreds of Fraser River sockeye salmon emerge from the sea as they pull in their reef nets. This year's run of sockeye on Canada's Fraser River dwarfed scientists' expectations. Nearly 35 million came back from the ocean to the Fraser or got intercepted by fishing boats along the way. That's more than any year since 1913. It's also a huge turnaround from last year's disastrously small returns. This year, millions of Fraser sockeye swam through Washington state waters before turning north toward Vancouver and their spawning grounds upstream. It's Canada's biggest salmon fishery and a major one for nine Washington tribes and non-tribal fishers in northern Puget Sound.
Then all of a sudden we get this huge salmon run, which is really an enormous event.
Tim Parsons thinks the Fraser fishing fleet has the volcano to thank for its good fortune this year. He's a retired oceanography professor at the University of British Columbia. When Kasatochi erupted, this year's sockeye would have been about 2 years old. They'd be swimming around the Gulf of Alaska when suddenly there's a lot more food on their table.
Salmon don't eat phytoplankton directly, but the food chain set off by that ash and the phytoplankton growing was enough to cause a considerable increase in growth and survival of the Fraser River salmon.
Parsons says this year's sockeye would have been at just the right age to benefit from a sudden spurt in their food supply. Biologist Ray Hilborn at the University of Washington is skeptical. He says it's unlikely that the volcano could benefit just one of the many salmon stocks that swim in the Gulf of Alaska. Tim Parsons says salmon migrate to discrete areas in the Gulf, so it's possible that one run might benefit while others don't. Theories abound on why the Fraser sockeye failed to show up last year and why they showed up in extraordinary numbers this year. Bill Crawford is a research scientist with Fisheries and Oceans Canada. He says Parsons' volcano hypothesis is plausible, but proving it or disproving it will be tricky.
Basically, we don't know where any one individual stock of salmon goes in the deep sea waters for its last 2 years of life. They're pretty well out of sight, you know, beyond our radar, so to say.
Tim Parsons says he's gotten a lot of skeptical reactions to his idea that a volcano could essentially produce salmon.
Oh, yes. That's what science is all about. There are a couple of scientists who are very enthusiastic and support it. There are probably at least a couple of dozen scientists who say, no, no, that couldn't be.
Parsons isn't just some retired guy with a crazy theory. Last week in Portland, a conference of oceanographers held a symposium celebrating Parsons' 50 years of research. The Canadian government even awards a Timothy Parsons Award for oceanography each year. I'm John Ryan reporting.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and the Northwest News Network's John Ryan in Seattle. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Alaska's first pioneer home opened in Sitka in 1913. Continuing the tradition of loving care, five more pioneer homes opened over the years, including a veterans home in Palmer. If you are 65 years or older, need assisted living, and an Alaska resident for the past year, you can apply to live in a Pioneer home. Information at 888-355-3117 or at the State of Alaska DHSS website. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.